Ether George is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and has been since October 2011. She's the ninth president and chief executive officer of the 10th District Federal Reserve Bank here in Kansas City. A native of St. Joseph, she joined the bank in 1982 and served as a commissioned bank examiner until 1995, when she was named to the bank's official staff. She's held numerous leadership positions at the bank, including first vice president of the bank, and this is her first appearance on Up to Date. And Esther George, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Well, a lot of people, as you know, have absolutely no idea what the Fed does, and I want to talk about that today. Most people do know it's important, and I'm wondering, is that frustrating for you that you do a job and a lot of folks just don't quite get it?
Well, it's not frustrating. It's a good opportunity for us to talk about what the central bank does. When times are good, we operate behind the scenes. And when there's a crisis, we're out in front. So it's a fair question for people to have.
You've been out in front a lot the last few years. You know, there's a little question that the last 5 to 7 years have been just extraordinary times for the Fed. How extraordinary, in your view?
I think historically extraordinary. So this was a financial crisis, a recession that we have not experienced in this country probably since the Great Depression. So the actions of the central bank required a fair amount of creativity, being aggressive in responding to that crisis. And because of that, we undertook actions that we have not done before.
You know, a lot of folks say the recovery has been kind of slow, unemployment rate still a little too high, the economy still a little sluggish. Given all that, as you look back at how the Fed did respond in those, you know, amazing days in 2007, 2008, how well did the bank respond in your view as you look back on it now?
Well, the bank responded as it was intended to, I think, by Congress, which was to provide liquidity in a time of panic. History will judge ultimately how well we did. It will take many years, I think, for us to know what the ultimate effect of these policies were. But during the panic, during a time when markets were seizing up, the role of the central bank is to provide liquidity, and it did that.
Hey, how closely were you watching all that in those days, Esther, and where were you? What was your vantage point of overseeing these historic days?
Well, at the time that the crisis unfolded in 2008, I was head of our bank supervision operations here in Kansas City, and so I had essentially a front row seat to that. In 2009, I went to Washington and served as the interim director in Washington for their bank supervision function, where I had an even closer look at what was happening during that time.
That's a really close look at what
was
happening.
It was very close.
What were you hearing back from banks at that time in terms of what they were saying, what they were worried about?
Well, it was a classic recession in the sense that credit dried up, which
quickly
meant
yeah.
businesses had to let people go. And banks that did not have sufficient capital failed. And so it was a frightening time for bankers. It was a frightening time for the public to see what was happening.
You know, given what was going on with the whole mortgage loan industry, were you someone who maybe had foreseen or had been concerned about maybe what was coming down the road, if not to the extent of what happened? But how concerned were you in the years leading up to that moment?
Well, in the years leading up to that, remember, we had very low interest rates at a time when housing prices were growing steadily. Credit was easy, underwriting standards were pretty loose, and that combination throughout history can be one that brings problems, and this one certainly did when the housing bubble burst.
So you had been concerned?
There were concerns. There were many warning signs. I don't think I certainly did not appreciate the global magnitude of what was about to happen in 2008.
You know, it seems to me that there's still a lot of Americans who don't realize just how close this country came to, you know, something that would border on a cataclysmic economic meltdown. What's your sense? How close did we come?
Well, it was a serious recession and financial crisis. And what we learned through that were there were institutions that were too big to fail, meaning the taxpayer had to step in and rescue those. That proved that we had a big problem on our hands. Millions of Americans lost their job because of this recession. So it was enormous in terms of its impact. We are still feeling that impact today.
A lot of folks say too big to fail hasn't changed all that much, even in the intervening years. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that's true. The institutions are bigger today than they were going into the crisis. Regulatory reform is attempting to address that issue of too big to fail, but I think has yet to demonstrate that we've been able to do that. So until that happens, the taxpayer is still at risk.
And that's a political issue more than it is an issue for the Fed, right?
Well, the Fed is a supervisor. Today, in fact, the banking agencies are making decisions about the level of capital that these largest institutions will have to hold. So the Federal Reserve is very involved in the supervision of these largest institutions, setting the rules in motion, setting the capital framework for them. And that is an important role right
now. So given that, are we safer? Is the taxpayer safer today than he or she was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago?
The levels of capital are higher, and that's the part of the banking system that is designed to absorb loss. But our work is not done in that area. And policymakers will have to continue to address that issue as long as we have a concentrated banking system. Those institutions are still a risk, if you will, to the economy as a whole.
How much higher are the requirements for capital holdings today compared to 4 or 5 years ago? Are there some general statements you can say about that?
Right. So for every dollar of assets, a bank today has to hold 3 cents of capital. And that the new requirements would propose to double that. That is still not a tremendously high level. It will be higher than we had. So we're moving in the right direction. But that level of loss-absorbing capital for the banking system, along with supervisors who go in and periodically check the risk, is important to the safety and soundness of our banking system.
Is that doubling of this capital holding requirement, is that a Fed decision or a congressional decision?
Well, in the Dodd-Frank Act, in the regulatory reform, there were rules about adding more capital. The regulators then write those rules. And so the Federal Reserve works globally with other central banks around the world to set those capital ratios, as well as with the banking agencies in the United States.
So the Fed had some latitude as to how far it wanted to go.
Yes, it did.
And the decision's been made to go from 3 to 6,
yes.
It sounds like. I gather by your comments that your desire would have been to go farther than that.
I think we could have gone higher. I think that would have provided more cushion. But I think this is certainly moving in the right direction in terms of adding more capital to the banking system.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Esther George is with us. She's the new president, not so new, but she's been around since October 2011, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Your questions for Esther, always welcome here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can drop us an email to uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. You know, I'm just wondering, you know, what you do always strikes me as just so complex, you know, just enormous complexity. How do you keep – what's your daily routine? How do you keep up with all this regulatory stuff you've got to keep up with?
Well, I have a great staff of people, first of all.
Yeah, you got to have that, right?
There are about 1,200 employees here in Kansas City.
Wow.
And if you include our branch offices, about 1,500 in total. And it is their job to carry out the role of the central bank in the 7-state region that we represent. So I rely heavily on them to inform me of where the economy is. We have a staff of economists. The bank supervisors report on the condition of the banking system and how the economy is unfolding through the financial system. And, of course, we play a role in making sure that the payment system is operating safe and soundly. So we're distributing cash out of the Kansas City office and our Denver office, which are important functions here in the Midwest.
You oversee how many states?
We have 7 states. So that
Wyoming,
extends
from Colorado.
Wyoming, Colorado,
Nebraska.
New Mexico, mm-hmm. Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri.
What are you noticing about the economy in those states these days? What are the trends? What are you seeing in our neck of the woods out here?
Well, each of those states is a little bit different, but in general, that region is driven by the energy sector, by the ag sector. Tourism in some of those states is very important. So we see the regional economy continuing to grow. In fact, in some of our states, employment is so low right now that, the levels of unemployment are so low that businesses are beginning to have problems finding the right people to fill their jobs.
And where is that?
Nebraska, Wyoming, Oklahoma. So those states responded more quickly. They didn't experience the crisis in the same way that some parts of the country did. But on the whole, you will find our region performing about in line with the nation as a whole. So we still have a ways to go to bring down unemployment. There's still opportunity for more growth. But important sectors there being energy and ag in our region.
When you look at western Kansas and the impact of this devastating drought, what are you seeing there in terms of how tough is it out west and what kind of impact is that having on the economy here in the heartland?
Well, drought is always an issue that we deal with in this part of the country and have for several years. So depending on whether there is irrigation or not, that, of course, affects the yields. To date, there has been government subsidy, which has stepped in to support some of those farmers in that region when they experience drought. But that always is a factor in terms of those areas that are dependent on commodities for their economies.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Esther George. She's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. We'll talk a little bit more about interest rates, the national economic situation, and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour, Esther George is with us. She's president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. We're taking your phone calls at 816-235-2888. We want to know, should the Fed start raising interest rates? Has the time come or not? Again, 816-235-2888, or email us at uptodate@kcur.org, or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Let's go to some phone calls here and go to Doug from Raytown. Doug, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if they still offer tours of the Federal Reserve here in Kansas City, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yes, I think they do. Esther?
Yeah. We certainly do, and we would be delighted to have you come visit us at 1 Memorial Drive. We offer tours Monday through Friday in our building there, and you can look into the cash vault as well as see a gold bar and a number of other exhibits there in our lobby.
I was a little disappointed you didn't bring along a couple of gold bars just for me to hang on to for a while.
Yeah, they're a little serious about keeping that under wraps.
Imagine that, yeah. I wanted to get back to your sort of daily routine and how you monitor what you monitor and what do you monitor all day. Give us a sense of when you get in the office and what are the first things you look at, Esther, when you hit the desk?
Well, there are a number of sources of information, and some of them are the very same ones that the general public has access to. So I read the paper like everyone else.
Good for you.
Look at market sources, listen to the financial news. Another source of very important information for the Federal Reserve, though, comes from our contacts in the region. So we have lots of data that tell us what the economy has done and how it's performed. But our engagement with our directors who serve on the Kansas City Fed Board, meeting with local businesses throughout that region, give us the real context around how the economy is unfolding.
So you're talking to real people out there is what you're saying.
Absolutely. You have to talk to people in what I call the real economy. So manufacturers here in Kansas City, talking to tourism industry in Denver, Colorado, talking to the energy sector in Oklahoma City, trying to understand ag in the Omaha office. All of those provide a rich context for what's happening in the economy.
You know, as president of a Federal Reserve Bank, again, here in Kansas City, are there certain numbers you look at, certain, you know, indices that you're watching very closely to see what in the world is going on during the course of any given day?
Well, there are many, and it's always hard to pin down which one is more important than the other. In the context of what the Federal Reserve has been asked to do by Congress, which is to make sure that we have stable prices or low inflation, We're always watching to see how prices are unfolding in the economy and seeing how employment, so the health of the economy, is reflected in how many jobs are being developed and are people working.
You know, one of the big issues facing the Fed these days is when to begin raising interest rates to keep inflation in check. You've wanted them raised long before now. In fact, you've said that rates have been too low for too long. Why do you feel that way?
Well, that has been in my view. And in 2013, when I was a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, I expressed my concern that we were doing too much, I felt. Rates were already at zero.
With the quantitative easing and all of those
extraordinary
steps you've
been taking. And so we continued with extraordinary measures like quantitative easing. And my concern was twofold. One is that over the long term, it could spark inflation. And the other concern was by staying low for long, we were creating imbalances in the economy.
In what sense?
We would create incentives for people to reach for yield, take on more risk than they might otherwise do. So having monetary policy influence people's decisions for a long period of time, I thought was unhealthy for the long-term recovery of our economy. And because of that, I voted against the policy.
You've been a lone wolf making those kinds of statements. How does that work for you, being the lone dissenting voice in a group like the Fed?
Well, you have to remember that the ability to vote is an important public responsibility, and I took it that way. And it is important that you approach those decisions with a great deal of humility, that you inform yourself as best you can. But it is my public responsibility, I felt, to vote my conscience, to vote how I saw those issues. And so whether or not it was the majority view, I thought it was more important to express what I felt like was an important view to have at that table. And so in that context, I felt like I had to do that.
Now, the Fed has begun to signal that these low interest rates aren't going to continue forever, which, of course, is a very delicate step for the Fed to take to begin to signal to the markets that this is the long-term course of the Fed. What has been said and what do you make of it?
Well, last December, the Federal Open Market Committee made a decision that it would begin to reduce the amount of asset purchases, or QE, that it was undertaking. I supported that decision. I thought it was important to get started on what is likely to be a very long path toward getting back to normal
interest rates. This is the buying up of debt out there that has been undertaken as a way to inject more cash into the economy, basically.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And it also served to lower longer-term interest rates. So in addition to lowering short-term rates, which we call the federal funds rate, quantitative easing, or the purchase of these longer-term treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, pushed down on longer-term rates, which of course is where people that are borrowing to buy automobiles or businesses investing in long-term capital projects
was designed
to influence that.
The Fed wanted that to happen to gin up the economy to get things moving again.
Absolutely. The stated purpose of that policy was to boost the economy, and explicitly to boost asset prices such as housing and stocks as an alternative to safer investments.
Now, a lot of folks listening to this might think, well, you know, things still aren't all that honky-dory out there. Why back off that policy as you're advocating?
Well, the economy has been growing, and policy, such as the Fed's, is one that can't be fine-tuned. So actions we take today can take anywhere from 6, 12, 18 months to affect the economy. So we can't wait until we see the all clear, if you will.
Because by then it might be too
late. It may be too late. And the risk associated with that may be too far to undo in a way that allows the economy to continue to grow.
Again, we're visiting with Fed President Esther George of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. This low interest rate period that we're in right now, is this the longest duration of rates this low that we've ever experienced before in this country, or have there been precedents for going this long with rates this low?
There have been periods of very low interest rates for extended period of time. What is unusual now is we are at essentially zero interest rates and have been there since 2008. If you subtract the low level of inflation, we've actually been at negative interest rates for a long time. That's unusual relative to most episodes where there's a recession. The Fed may drop interest rates, but then as the recovery takes hold, it begins to move to normalize. This has been an unusual period. It's been unusual globally that economies have not bounced back faster.
And I really appreciate the way you're explaining this so clearly. It's helpful even for a guy like me that struggles with this stuff. But the fact that rates have been as low as they've been, that takes away an important tool that the Fed has to help deal with the economy. With interest rates off, they can't go any lower. That ushered in this era of buying up these long-term debts that you were talking about. That's the other secondary tool you have at your disposal, and that's why the Fed did what it did, right?
Right. So being at zero interest rates, the action then was to begin to buy up longer-term bonds so that we could also influence longer-term interest rates and hopefully spur not only borrowing – but asset values. And in fact, you've seen some of that through housing prices, through stock market valuations. And remember, at the same time, those that suffer from this policy are those that rely on interest income. So seniors, those living on fixed incomes, those that typically buy safer investments are now paying the price of zero interest rates.
Well, is it time to raise interest rates? Is it time for the Fed to change course here on this key economic policy that so much influences our country? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here again. UpToDate at kcur.org is our email address. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air with Esther George. Good morning.
How much longer will savers have to wait? It sounds like you're talking like it's going to be a long time. We're underwriting the banks as it is.
Esther?
Well, this is an important question for people that rely on interest income. Right now, the Federal Reserve in its statements has said that it will continue as long as the economy performs as it has been to reduce its bond purchases or its quantitative easing. And then it will be a considerable period of time before it raises the short-term interest rate. And, of course, that's the question everyone wants to know is when exactly is that? If you look at the projections that the Federal Open Market Committee has put out, it suggests that it will be the middle of 2015 or 2016 before that short-term interest rate would go up. And, of course, that depends on how the economy continues to perform.
Mike, what
do
you make of that?
How can you encourage people to save?
Well, it is a policy that does not encourage savings. Zero interest rates are designed to spur people to borrow or to invest. And that has been one of my concerns, that over a long period of time, the consequences to the importance of saving and to those that depend on those savings is undermining our longer-term goals.
Mike, I appreciate it. Yeah, one more. Go ahead.
No, you recommend putting your money under a mattress?
Well, I know exactly the concern you have, and that is the challenge. When I hear from people that are suffering right now from zero interest rates, their choices are to take on risk that may not serve them well in the long term or to begin to eat into the principal of their savings. Neither one of those, I know, are good choices right now for people.
Thank you, Mike. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. And a listener emailed us this question, Esther. When the Federal Reserve purchases mortgage-backed securities in the billions of dollars for its monthly quantitative easing, for its monthly quantitative easing, how do you decide whose portfolio you will actually purchase and how will you ultimately sell them or will the Fed hold them until maturity?
Very good question. When the Fed goes into the market to buy, whether it's Treasury securities or mortgage backs, it is buying in the open market, if you will, in the secondary markets. And so we are bidding for those assets, and we are a large buyer of those assets. Today, the Fed's balance sheet has grown from about $900 billion pre-crisis to $4.3 $1.5 trillion today. And the question of whether how it will normalize that balance sheet is very much on the mind of policymakers today.
Normalize meaning how will you disperse of those assets at some point down the road?
So under normal times, we would begin to shrink that balance sheet by putting those assets back in the market, lowering bank reserves, and causing the interest rate to move up. But this is a very large balance sheet, and we have not had experience in a balance sheet this size. So the committee is talking a lot about how it will start the process, what it will do with its mortgage portfolio. In past minutes that have been released of those meetings, there has been discussion that the Fed may hold that bond portfolio of mortgages until they mature. So very much an issue for the committee to have in front of it in terms of how it begins to move away from this policy.
How much concern is there that the Fed will actually end up losing money on that portfolio over the long run?
Well, if you look at the Fed's financial statements, you will see that we report that bond portfolio at a market value. And, of course, because it is a longer-term portfolio, it is already beginning to show losses. And as interest rates rise, there will be more of that. That doesn't affect the Fed's ability to conduct monetary policy. But it is very visible to the public to see that that portfolio has losses. And that, of course, could raise political questions. It could raise questions from the public about the Federal Reserve's balance sheet.
Your concern is you're outlining it here today, Esther, is the long-term risk of inflation. What are you seeing right now as you gauge into your series of economic indicators that talk about inflation? What is happening on that front? Are you seeing much movement yet or not?
If you look at the official measures of inflation, right now they look pretty low, under 1.5%. And the Federal Reserve has set a target for itself of 2%. One of the things I watch, though, in addition to those inflation numbers, is what's happening with asset prices. So we do see a pretty healthy rise in the stock market. We have seen housing values come back.
Well, the market's gone nuts.
And so the question today is whether the economy is exhibiting the same types of inflation. We don't see people's wages rising. That usually is a precursor to higher inflation. But we also know from history that inflation can catch hold pretty quickly. So even though we don't see it today, it's something you have to constantly monitor.
So given that, I mean, what a difficult task it must be to try to gauge when and if inflation's going to rear its head again. As you outline that, boy, what a complicated set of factors you're weighing here. You know, you're right. Personal wages aren't going up. People aren't seeing that at all these days. And you wonder if they will anytime soon, which is a huge factor you're weighing here.
Right. And so my issue has been we've set the conditions. We have $2.5 trillion of reserves in the banking system that, as the economy strengthens, could begin to flow out. The ability to respond quickly. What I'd like to avoid is having to raise rates rapidly.
Yeah.
And so the sooner we move in careful, gradual steps, I think the more important to help us both manage that eventuality, what happens with inflation, while not unsettling the markets and the economy today.
What are you seeing when it comes to the health of the banks themselves and the health of the borrowing climate out there? You know, can people get loans? Can farmers get loans? Are you seeing the automobile industry seems to be doing pretty well? What's happening with that? What's happening with mortgages and buying houses these days?
Well, banks are healthier today, and they have plenty of money to lend.
Are they lending it?
They are lending to creditworthy borrowers. And so credit standards, and I think necessarily so, have
went
raised.
Up. Mm-hmm.
That's
a good thing, I gather, given what we just went through.
It's a good thing for the long-term health of the economy. What we see now, and households generally had too much debt going into this crisis. So 130% of income, if you looked at a national level, was the debt level that households had. That was very high. It put them in a precarious position.
Does that include mortgages?
Included their mortgages, mm-hmm. included credit card debt. So households have been shoring up their balance sheets, if they will, being stronger. The appetite to borrow is not there in the same way that it was going into the recession. We do see auto lending growing. That is one of the fastest moving categories of debt that households are taking on.
And that's a pretty good sign, I would gather.
It's been a good sign for the auto industry. If you look just, though, in the last 6 months, most of that debt went to people with some of the lowest credit scores. So, again, watching underwriting standards, watching how that unfolds for the long term will be important.
Borrowing money to buy a house, is it too difficult in your view, or is it about where it needs to be based, again, on the numbers that you're looking at here?
Well, underwriting has certainly shifted, and there are new rules coming out that dictate how mortgages should be lent. I think it will be a while before people have the same appetite for mortgage debt, before they qualify for the same levels of that. That will be a function of more jobs, more wage growth to help them borrow. But I think clearly underwriting has shifted in the mortgage industry, and it is stronger today than it was.
How did you get interested in all this? You were raised – you're from St. Joseph.
I am. I grew up south of St. Joseph on a farm.
Were you into money? Were you counting, saving money as a kid in your piggy bank, or how did you get going on all this?
Well, I had jobs working on the farm early on, but one of my first jobs –
Like what kind of jobs?
I worked in the soybean and cornfields. So,
you were actually out in the fields?
I was out in the fields.
Doing what?
I was. We used to pull weeds out of the soybean fields and detassel corn. So.
Yeah. And how did you get paid for doing that?
Not well. It was my dad's farm. So.
Does he owe you a little bit still? Back debt there?
Not
Esther?
At all. Yeah. I learned a great deal. But one of my first jobs in high school was to work for a bank. I was a teller at a bank, and it was my first introduction to the banking system and finance, and I enjoyed it from the beginning.
I was going to say, what was it about that tripped your trigger so much? What did you enjoy so much about it?
Well, compared to working in a soybean field.
It was an easy call, right?
The air conditioning felt pretty good.
Yeah.
The finance was interesting, and I started as a borrower myself. I wanted to go on an international trip as a foreign exchange student.
Ah.
My parents were very supportive but very clear that that would be a trip that I would finance myself. And so I worked with the bank to get a loan, to set up payments, I made the trip, and I paid back the loan.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. How much money did you borrow for the trip?
I can't remember. I think it was about $2,000 many years ago.
So. And that's a lot of money back in those days.
It was a lot of money for me. Yeah.
So you learned a lot about frugality and all that kind of thing from mom and dad.
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
And you went to school where? Remind us where you went.
I went, of course, I went to high school in Missouri, and I went to college through my master's at Missouri Schools.
And right here, right?
Where I got my master's degree from University of Missouri in Kansas City and my undergrad at Missouri Western in St. Joe.
Then out to Stanford, too, I think, right?
I did an executive program at Stanford, and I learned a great deal through the banking crisis of the 1980s working as a bank examiner for the Federal Reserve.
Boy. Well, the Fed, as most of us know, has a new head. Janet Yellen has taken the place of Ben Bernanke. How is she different? How's her style different? What can we expect from her going forward, do you think?
Well, I know Janet Yellen well. She has been part of the Federal Reserve System for some time, both as a president at the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank as well as a governor in Washington.
The first woman to hold that position.
First woman to hold that position. She is well-qualified and a distinguished economist. She has signaled, and I think rightly, that the transition will be smooth between the former chairman and herself.
As it needs to be.
As it's important. The eyes of the world are on that transition. And I look forward to working with her.
How will she be different than Ben Bernanke? What can we expect? What would the average consumer watching her expect that maybe that would be different than what Bernanke used to do?
Well, it's early on. I think we'll have to see how she changes her approach or style, if any at all. Her experiences at the San Francisco Fed would involve talking to people in the real economy. She has spent time in her first testimony to Congress on monetary policy. Her first time out, spent 6 hours answering questions. So I take that as a sign she intends to be accessible and to engage in a very transparent way with Congress and the public.
Yeah, Esther, how many women are in positions like yours as head of the bank here in Kansas City? What's the percentage of women who hold your position around the country?
There is one other woman that heads a Federal Reserve Bank in Cleveland. Sandy Pianalto, she will be retiring on June 1st.
Wow.
And her successor will also be a woman.
Okay.
So there will be two women heading Federal Reserve banks in 2014.
Is that a concern of yours, the number of women who are in the pipeline to handle these kinds of positions and take on these very high-profile responsibilities?
It's not a concern. I assume that women that are qualified have those opportunities to come to those positions. More importantly is that you attract people that have the long-term interest of the Federal Reserve, that come to that table with informed and independent views. That's what makes the difference for the Federal Reserve.
You know, it's been such a pleasure to have you here today. Thanks for
coming
in.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And I really appreciated the clear-headed way you explained so much of this. It's just great to hear it, and I could even understand it, and that just helped a whole lot. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Again, that's Esther George. She's President and Chief Executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. You can find more information about all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, and Cody Newell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.